Larry Levine, self-taught in criminal law and tired of seeing people getting ripped off or burned by the system, is ready to talk one-on-one with you. It's not about who's right or wrong. It's who's a better liar. And now the host of Street Justice, Larry Levine.
Show Street Justice with Larry Levine. Today is what, the 20th of
January
2020. I'm joined right now, I believe, by Sid Blitz in Venice. No, Sid is in, where you are, Sid? Are you in Century City or Venice?
I am in Century City, sitting in my beautiful car showroom adjacent to Beverly Hills and the Nakatomi Plaza at Fox Studios. And sitting here with $1 million worth of beautiful cars.
Vintage. $1 million worth of cars. Are they all heavily insured?
Of course.
Hey, Sid, do you know what Jewish lightning is? You ever heard that term?
What's the term?
Jewish lightning.
Oh, of course. It's called Jewish lightning.
Yeah.
That's a very familiar term.
That was a term that was used back in the 60s, 70s in New York primarily. And
Brooklyn.
It's when a Jewish businessman wanted to get out of business. He was heavily insured, and they would torch the place to get the insurance money. They called it quits.
Let me embellish upon that. Usually,
we're not going to torch $1 million worth of cars. So anyway,
yeah, usually the Jewish lightning was somewhat what you just said, but it's usually in conjoinment with some mob guys. And mob guys would go into a restaurant, and they would build up. The guy had credit, so they would start buying all this merchandise, alcohol, and food and stuff. So it was all on credit. So it was coming in the front door, going out the back door. At wholesale prices. And then when they built up enough money that they owed, instead of filing for bankruptcy or something, what they would do is just like you said, the place would be insured, they'd torch it, everybody walk away with a lot of money.
That was Jewish lightning. Goodfellas.
What's that, Larry?
Remember that movie Goodfellas?
Yes, sir.
They did that in the movie Goodfellas.
Yes, they did.
Shit came in the back, or came in the front, went out the back. I'm going to mic myself up just a little bit better. Sid, can you hear me better?
I can hear you fine. You were echoing a little bit.
But I'm not echoing now.
No, you sound much better. Let me tell you about one local scenario that kind of fits that deal. There was a place in the 90s up on Sunset Boulevard, and it was called Thunder Roadhouse. And a Jewish guy I know opened the place up, and it was a bar, a restaurant. It was a boutique gift shop. Next to it was a showroom with a bunch of Harley Davidson choppers. And in the 90s, there was this big, huge surge in people wanting to be bikers for the weekend and wear leathers and get new Harleys and, you know, kind of pretend to be what they weren't. But, you know, it's weekend warrior stuff. So my friend opens up this place called Thunder Roadhouse on Sunset Boulevard, just down from Crescent Heights, and it's immensely successful. I mean, the place is packed. Bikers are coming, and they have bike night, and they got the bar, and they got the boutique. I mean, the whole place is jumping. So one time, it only takes one time, all of a sudden, I think it was a Thursday night, all of a sudden, one of the walls just burst into flames. And there's people packed in this place. So everybody goes running out the street.
Magic,
and basically, the place burnt to the ground right there.
Sid, that sounds like magic to me.
It sounds like Jewish lightning to me. Yeah, he was, I think the guys that had Hard Rock were silent partners in that place. And it was a great concept. The timing was perfect, but it burnt to the ground. So many years later, I asked him, I said, come on, level with me. Was that some Jewish lightning or what? And you know what he told me? He said, no. He said, what actually happened is if you went into the bar, it was all kind of like rustic wood, you know, like a roadhouse bar.
Sure.
They had all these neon signs everywhere of all the alcohol people that were advertising, you know, the beverages. He said the last guy that went in there put up a sign, spliced into a wire, and that didn't work out. It just shorted, and it was a natural thing. It burnt a place to the ground. But that's kind of the same scenario.
Shit happens is all I can say. All right, it's about 7 minutes after the hour. We've got Dawn Marie. I don't know if she's on with us right now.
I'm on. Hi, Sid. Hi, Larry.
Hey,
hi, Dawn.
Dawn is alumni. This whole show, essentially, all our guests, everybody on here has done federal time. Or they're involved in criminal activity of some, or they were, excuse me. They were involved in criminal
allegedly.
Now we are all upstanding business people, successful authors, if you will. Dawn has written a book called The Accidental Spy, and it kind of outlines what she was doing before she went to prison, how her conviction took place. So, Dawn, tell our listeners, what's the book about? I mean, what the fuck happened?
Well, it's, you know, the book is about basically gives the reader a snapshot into like who I am and how things transpired. And really, and it's written obviously in fiction, but it's based on real events about my time inside the Atwood Hall Federal Prison Camp in Lexington and how I kind of used my entrepreneurial skills to thrive and, you know, have my entourage and made some friends along the way and, you know, do the time 6 years. And, you know, that was it. Basically just kind of goes through characters, the cast of characters, all talking about the case in between. It's woven in with my family and what happened and what I was accused of.
So, Dawn, what was it you were accused of? Give us some backstory.
Well, the backstory is I was a power broker back in the day. You know, successful, living abroad. I was accused of conspiracy to break a trade embargo with Iraq. So that means that they basically said I shipped goods that I knew were going to Iraq in violation of the sanctions and the embargo prior to the war. So that's, and then money laundering, of course, and conspiracy and all that extra stuff that comes with it.
So I heard at one point, I don't remember where I heard it because I heard a lot of shit. Didn't they accuse you of selling technology to Saddam Hussein?
This was it. The cell phone system, GSM, that our military, you know, basically was going to use. Because this was a CIA operation, right? You know, I was selling it to the CIA. I didn't know, and that had come out later, but it's sealed. They said that I was supplying Saddam his technology on the eve of war, his cellular system to have cell phones inside of Iraq, one of the countries in the world that didn't have it. But it wasn't true. It was for our country to go in and listen and spy so that they could pinpoint the invasion, take down the Saddam Hussein regime. That's what that was going to be for.
So
I was participating with the U.S.
So, Dawn, this was actually all a fucking hoax, if you will.
Pretty much. And so, I was a scapegoat for that. The U.S. wanted to get this gear into their hands or Saddam's hands so that they could listen. It's that spying program where they look at, you know, worldwide leaders and then they can listen and gather intel. That's what this was for. It was GSM for the CIA and military.
So basically, you were actually helping the U.S.
Exactly.
And military.
I was helping them, but then they said
And then basically they hung you out to dry.
They flipped the script on me when I wouldn't cooperate and, you know, try to help them homegrown terrorists and proffer and all of that. So they threw the book at me.
So they wanted you to take it one step beyond, and morally and ethically, you decided, well, I'm gone as far as I'm going to go, and I'm not going to cross that line. And then
right.
They figured, well, we'll just make her the fall guy.
Anyway.
Pretty standard operating procedure
standard,
for U.S.
Yeah, I don't think I want to go work for feds, and I didn't do what they said I did anyway. I'm like, maybe an export violation if I did anything. it was your stuff. The CIA was buying this. And that all came out after my sentence.
So you were like, that's hence my case in the field. They needed someone they can put blame on. They set the deal up. They used you as a fucking pawn. And then they fucked you on the back end.
She was Lee Harvey Oswald.
Something like that.
Something like that.
So, Dawn,
but
Timothy McVeigh.
Yeah, really. Dawn, how much time do you end up doing?
Well, they asked for a sentence of 20 years, right? But I ended up doing 6. So 4 years, 8 months, 27 days in Kentucky the whole time.
Did you count the seconds, too?
I did. I mean, I did. It was like, get me out of here. 4 years, 8 months, 27 days, and 15 minutes.
You know, it's funny, so when gone. I would go to unit team, for those of you that don't know what that is, that's the when they would have like a meeting and you're in custody with a counselor, a case manager, a unit manager, maybe one or two of them, but I call them the Three Stooges. They are actually the people that are in charge of you administratively while you're in custody. And I would go to these meetings and they would ask me, well, how long have you been in? How much time do you have left? And before the meeting, I would check this out. I would figure it out in minutes, and I would figure it out in seconds. And I would say, well, I've been in about hours, and I have so many hours left. And they're looking at me like I'm fucking crazy. They were doing this every 6 months, so generally it was different people. They didn't realize I had done that before. Then I would tell them, well, if you can't figure out the hours, let me expand on that. Let me tell you how many seconds that was. And this is how many seconds I had left. My numbers were close. They weren't on the money. But these people who worked for the BOP, the Bureau of Prisons, they weren't going to check this out. They took it for granted. These people could barely tie their fucking shoes when it comes down to it. You know, an average police academy in the United States, law enforcement academy, 9 months maybe, could be a year. Sid or Dawn, do you know how long the Bureau of Prisons Academy is? Either of you.
2 weeks?
There's a guess. Dawn, do you know?
2 weeks?
Where they go to get trained?
Yeah.
A week.
It's an hour. No.
Well,
I always said this. It was people who couldn't get a job, like either they flunked out of the military or couldn't get a rejects, right? People that couldn't really work in mainstream society or I don't know. I was in the post office. Yeah, I was in team one day thinking to myself, you would be at Burger King at the drive-thru if this job wasn't available to you. Really, the dumbest
people.
That's funny.
Hold on. That's funny you would say that. First of all, it's 21 days. That's how long this is. Their training academy takes longer to be a manager to work at McDonald's. I would tell staff, and I was in 11 different facilities over 10 years. Move me around a lot because they were a little pissed off at me helping other inmates. I would tell them the only reason they were working there is because Walmart found more qualified people than them. So they are the dregs of society. Sid, didn't you at one point at one of the places, Sid and I rode the federal system together. We kept piggybacking each other from one prison to the next. I'd get there before him. He'd get there before me. So didn't you comment once that BOP employees, it's kind of like you step in dog shit and you're scraping it off the bottom of your shoe on the sidewalk?
Well, yeah, my lawyer said, he said, most of these guards aren't worth the time to shine your shoes. That's literally how he explained it. He's like, they can shine your shoes. This is the quality of staff. I had a great Jewish attorney, by the way.
Of course. So, Larry, I don't really quite remember that. I do remember meeting you at MDCLA, and you kind of reminded me of Uncle Fester. You had these great big dark circles under your eyes, and you were trying to bone up on all these law books. And I said, Larry, what you should do is go down to the law library with me, and we should start planning where you want to go for your vacation. And we kind of took
travel
a couple of... We kind of took it on like a couple of tours. And I said, well, let's look at the available facilities and how many inmates are there and what they got to offer. And that's how we planned out our trip.
But how did you guys link up? Like, did you just by random chance you guys had met?
We met on 6 North at MDCLA in, I think, 1999, was it, Sid? And when I met Sid not long after the FBI grabbed his ass at Santa Monica Airport, I think it was.
Yeah.
On a cocaine conspiracy. Sid, when did they pop you? Was it 99?
I was flying in and out from Mexico. I had a big hotel in Puerto Vallarta and a compound in Guadalajara. And my partner and I had spent time in Boron together, and he decided to lead out of there one night in the middle of the night after the 10 o'clock count and never came back. And so when I went to my attorney and I said, look, my ex-partner Joey Ippolito has decided to turn state's evidence and rat out 52 people, mostly in New Jersey and me in California, I said, what should I do? And he said, file a 747 appeal. And I've said this before, and everybody goes, what? I said, you'll figure it out. But I met Larry because I was traveling between Mexico and the East Coast. I had established a home base in the East Coast, doing quite well. And I flew a private jet out to Santa Monica Airport with a load of cash on my way back down to Mexico. And unfortunately, another fellow who I'd known also became a rat. I met him and at the same time met a joint task force. But they put me in Santa Ana, and I was there for a while under an assumed name. And eventually the feds came and got me. Yeah, the feds eventually figured out who I was, came and got me, and that's when I met Larry. And I got to say, I'm a lucky guy because I met Larry. And we've had a lot of fun, great conversations. It's nice to meet really intelligent people, like Dawn also. It's good to meet people that figure out how the system works, and they can go through life with a smile, look for the silver lining. And like Larry, he's a really super intelligent guy, figures shit out. And so does Dawn, I can tell.
Well, I told Larry today, I love working with my network of amazing people I've met through Larry Levine. Sid, you're my favorite.
Thank you, Dawn. You're
like
one
Karen
of mine.
Marks too. I follow him on Facebook. His kids are super cute. Isn't that the blood and the razor wire guy?
Yeah, Chad, sure.
Yeah, Chad's got cute kids, two little twins.
Chad spent substantial time. Chad's doing good work on 2055s.
What did Chad go in for? I never understood. What did Chad go for?
Chad, I believe, was narcotics, I want to say.
Oh, was it?
I'm narcotics.
He looks like Charlie Brown. The guy looks like Charlie Brown.
Yeah. Like, I have the distinct honor. I mean, Sid, you had one indictment with multiple counts. I don't know how many. Doesn't matter. Dawn, you had one indictment with multiple counts.
99 counts.
99.
I was found guilty on all but one.
I had multiple indictments and multiple counts because on each one, because I was committing so many different crimes with so many different groups of people, they couldn't charge me all on one indictment. I mean, it's crazy the money that they waste. Well, we're going to get you here. It's kind of like the guy that goes in, gets charged, and we're going to give you life plus 99 years. Or the guy that's already in custody serving a life sentence. And I don't know, he kills somebody in custody. He does some major crime. So they bring him back to court, run him through the process again. It's like a wash and rinse. They bring him through the process again. Spent a ton of money reconvicting him when the guy's never going to leave prison anyway. It's all a hoax. It's all a waste. And it's the biggest fucking waste of time in America. I know
it is. And money and resources, too. It's really bad.
Yeah. I came up with a way they could actually save money on prosecutions and incarcerations. And it's through education, using the club network, let's say the alternative newspapers like the LA Weekly, the Village Voice. Every week they should print, they should buy ad space, and they should show a list of crimes. That if you do this and you steal this much money, or you're involved in narcotics trafficking, and this is the drug, and this is the quantity, and we charge you and catch you, this is how much time you're going to get. So it costs, I think the current cost of incarcerating one person a year, is it like $44,000 or something? Something around there.
I think the feds is higher.
Well, I just saw a recent, I saw a chart recently, and it was around 40 and change. Now, okay, let's factor in the cost of what we had to pay all the agents that caught the person, they conducted the investigation, the court costs, you got to pay the judge and the prosecutor and just everything, the public defender. So to prosecute somebody for a crime, we just spent $100,000 on the prosecution, round trip. Plus, it's going to cost us 40 and change to lock the guy up for the next 10 fucking years. So we're in this inmate for $500,000. Then he gets out. He's on supervised release for another 5 years. I don't know. What is that? $25,000 or $30,000 a year, they're figuring. So really, we're in this guy for maybe 600 and change. What if they spent, I don't know, $5,000, $10,000 running a full-page article? And if they were to discourage even 10 people every week, that's a good fucking investment, a good fucking return on their money. But they don't want to do it. They need to keep...
Yeah, look at me, Larry. They spent millions... I mean, they investigated me, customs agent, investigation only, from 2004 to 2008. And, I mean, they flew people to Iraq looking at the onion skin paper to see if I'd enter the country. Well, that wasn't cheap.
Hey, Don, they pursued me through two indictments for, what, like 8 years? Millions. I mean, went through all our records trying to find something to charge me with.
Lynn Espejo has joined us from Little Rock, Arkansas. Lynn, welcome back to the show.
Was that Lynn?
You can say something, Lynn. Yeah, this is Larry. Yes. Lynn has joined us from Little Rock, Arkansas. Lynn is an alumni. Lynn has also done federal time. So what they do is they go after people. They waste all this money. And they get so deep and so far into a case, they really know there's probably not merit, but they need to advance it forward so they can show that they're tough on crime. Lynn, how much time did you do? What were you sentenced to?
45 months, but because of the CARES Act, I got out after 27. So what was Lynn charged for? I don't even understand her crime. I don't...
I got charged
with wire fraud.
Yeah, doesn't understand her crime either.
I went to trial, Dawn, just like
I did too. Yeah, no, but what were you trying? I don't get it. I don't get what they say you did.
Short story, I worked for a group of doctors that were doing things, and when the feds came in, they tried to push their crimes basically off on me. The only thing I had done was I had
charged.
Sounds
like they were successful at it.
Yeah, they were. I had charged some items on my personal credit cards for one of the doctors, and well, actually a few of them, but mainly one of them, biggest amount, and he would have probably got tax fraud. So when instead of taking responsibility that he had actually charged personal items through the business and claimed them as business expenses, he just said he didn't authorize the repayment to me, and bam. There you go. The first prosecutor saw that I was innocent, and these doctors had destroyed, by the way, all the financial documents that would have proved, one, that I actually done something wrong, and two, would have proved that I hadn't done something wrong. So either way, why would you destroy them? So unless you didn't want to me to prove the truth. And I was not allowed to even tell the jury that they destroyed all the financial documents. But and they destroyed my work computer too, which was a brand new computer. Again, why would you do such? That would be proof of a crime, but they got rid of it. So the first prosecutor dismissed my case, but they had seized money for my husband and I. And because I fought them to get our money back and even reported the dirty prosecutor that took on trying to keep our money, reported him all the way to the OIG in Washington, D.C., he came right back after me. And then the second time, he charged me three ways. He charged me wire fraud. Then he said that at the time, my husband and I were building a house, and we had a construction loan. So
that Pancho, your husband Pancho?
Yes.
He's so cute. I follow you on Facebook.
Oh, thanks.
Your little dog, Macklin.
He hears you. So anyway, we had a construction loan, and every time we got a draw on that loan, it got deposited into our checking account, and I wrote checks to subcontractors. So for every one of those checks that I wrote to a subcontractor that was $10,000 or more, they said it was money laundering. Had nothing to do with the wire fraud they charged me with. They just made up a crime. Then they said, oh, and since you money laundered, you failed to report on the front page of your taxes that you had illegal money. Therefore, that's also tax fraud. And I got found guilty of all that because I was not even allowed to tell the jury that the evidence had been destroyed by the very doctors that said I did something.
That's ridiculous. They just roped you. I'm so confused. I still don't understand it. But so then you were
Dawn, that's why they call it the Just Us Department.
I don't get it. They make up shit. They keep coming and going. The husband and he's making the house on the rope him in. Like, well, yeah, they make up shit.
I mean, well, they kept threatening. You know, my husband's a CPA. They kept threatening me if I didn't take a plea deal, they were going to come after him. And they went as far, because we saw joint taxes, as getting approved to charge him. Then they didn't charge him. Guess what they did? They filed a motion with the court to give him immunity to testify against me, but we still never knew to what. Like, what was he going to testify to? Anything he would have said would have cleared me, because when I was charged the first time, he's also a forensic accountant besides the CPA. He went back through all our finances to just make sure that that I was not being dishonest about it, and found that, of course, his wife had done zero crime, nothing, nada. And he was just outraged at how this
and
went.
And this just started from the doctor's office. I thought Lynn was some, I couldn't follow it. I couldn't follow what they said you did. It's confusing.
Well, I mean, they changed their story several times. I don't think they knew. They when we got to trial, because, you know, people that get $600,000 extra dollars have a lot of toys, right? Boats, houses, you know, whatever. We only have a house we built that, you know, went along with our income, by the way. In fact, my husband was able to refinance that house only on his income, if that tells you anything. So, and I was making at the time $75 a year. So we lost $75 a year in income and could still have our same. We still have that house. But anyway, they told the jury we built a pool and pool house. All true, we did, on the same mortgage that we still pay and on the same bank loan that we showed at trial that covered all that and that we still had a big mortgage on. So there's all this money, they say. You know,
did,
like,
you have a jury trial, Lynn?
Did I what?
Did you have a jury trial, a jury of your peers?
Yes, 8 long days, and they voted everyone off the jury that said they had any accounting experience, had ever
any
built
brain.
A house, or any would even understand the case. The government voted those people off the jury so that I was with people that had no clue. They were like, one guy kept falling out of his chair.
No, oh my God, yeah, that's my jury. They were like the dumbest people on the planet. They fell asleep. They couldn't follow.
One lady was crying when they came back that morning that I was found guilty. The first charge was wire, you know, like there was so many charges of wire fraud. Then there was like maybe 6 money laundering, then 4 tax charges. When they read the first money laundering charge and they said guilty, I just laid my head down on the desk. And I could hear my husband sniffing, you know, starting to cry behind me. And this, I could just hear people crying, but I was so numb, I couldn't even shed a tear. Even when
I was the same way, Lynn. They were handing out six, and I think I was totaling. My friend was crying. I think she's counted like 96 years, and then my lawyer said, all you're looking for is concurrent, not consecutive, or consecutive, not concurrent, I don't know what the word was. I was numb, too. I was in shock.
Consecutive, I would be like, you had to serve them all. But, you know, the thing is, even at my sentencing, you know, the government was asking for 8 to 13 years. My judge gave me a two-level variance. She didn't let them have any of their enhancements, which got up to the 8 to 13 years. Then she gave me a two-level variance for my character reference letters. You know, people came spoke on my behalf, including my pastor even, about my character. And 165 people even wrote letters on my behalf talking about all the, you know, different things I had done to help people. And, you know, just the kind of person I was, all the charity work I'd done. Like, I'm talking about from 40 years back forward, even, you know, like not just I started doing it after I got accused of a crime. And it really impacted her. She talked about those letters a bunch, and she gave me a two-level variance, even at sentencing, which got me into the 41 to 51 month guideline, and then she gave me 4 to 5 months.
My judge went the other way. She was looking for 13 and then said, it was crazy. It's just the whole thing is just, I don't know, the whole thing is bizarre. The whole system, Larry, needs an overhaul.
Oh, I know. The whole system needs to be, it's like taking out the trash. They need to take out the trash. They need to start over. So, Dawn, you got, what
you know,
did you say
judge,
you got?
Dawn, my
Dawn,
judge gave me
months did you get?
After I got home from prison on the CARES, you know, the BOP, I was speaking out against the BOP, and they violated me from the CARES Act and had me out in the county jail to send me back to prison because I was standing up to them not only inside but now on the outside. And
ladies and gentlemen, the system was a good system up until 1984. They had a system where feds came after you and charged you. You had a fair system to go to trial. They could not get you indicted by a snitch or planting evidence or making up all these stories. And if you did get found guilty, you did, according to the laws of the land, say you got a 6-year sentence. You had to do 4 years on the 6 years because 1/3 of that time was guaranteed by Congress as good time for doing hard time. And there was a parole board. There was a parole board. And the parole board was set up to see you within 6 months of your sentencing and incarceration. And you went before the parole board twice before your 2-year date was up. And generally speaking, as long as you were programming and not causing problems, you would get a third out date. So against your 6 years, you did 2 years hard time, you got paroled, you spent 2 years on parole. That was their hook on you. And then as long as you didn't get any incidents, you were done with the whole deal. It was a very fair, equitable system. And the laws were different. Now you're going to say, hey, Sid, what happened? Well, it's real simple. Ronald Reagan, the spokesperson for GE, who could read a teleprompter better than a chimpanzee, got in power. He brought a guy named Meese, who was the Attorney General of California, with him.
Edwin Meese.
And these two amateur bozos got together with a guy named Rockefeller out of New York. They hired a Harvard professor, and they came out with the mandatory minimums, all in the name of the drug laws. And they changed the whole system and basically fucked everybody. And by the time 1990 rolled around and the new system was in, the old system was out, they were phasing out of the parole, they said, nobody gets a deal. Everybody's going away and doing 85%. And if you bring us to trial, we're going to punish you. Thank you. That's your history lesson, boys and girls.
And I think that's why I got compassionate release from my judge, even though I was sitting at a county jail on my way back to prison. I think judges look at this, and I don't think my case made sense to her, to be honest. And I think, she lowered my sentence way from what the government wanted. She did all that, and I still got compassionate release, even though I was sitting in a county jail on my way back to prison. And I really feel like that has to do with the fact that she was also confused.
Well, it's not confused, Lynn. When they ushered in these new laws and this new system of mandatory minimums, they took the power away from the judges and they gave it to the prosecutors and they said, okay, just get them convicted and they fall in that square. And Larry will tell you, the judge is locked into the square of what the mandatory and the maximum is. And that's all they can do. And the backlash is what you're seeing today is all this other stuff that's coming into play, the compassionate release, the dropping, getting extra good time. It's because judges, what's a judge going to do? He's going to sit there and be what? Oh, here's what the law prescribes. That's all I can do.
Before, yeah, their hands judges are so leave, high, they can't get.
Right.
Yeah.
And the government objects
to everything. And then the
government does.
Yeah.
They object to everything.
Hey, here's a new rule that just came out of the Sixth Circuit. On a 2255 motion, generally the court would go with what the prosecutor had to say, the DOJ. According to new Sixth Circuit case law, the court has to consider, give more consideration to evidence and such than is presented by the, that is presented by the defendant. So a 2255 nowadays is not necessarily just a rubber stamp deal to screw people. I'm going to put that up on the website. I'm going to put a link of that up.
Please do. That's out of the Sixth Circuit. That's my circuit.
This weekend, tomorrow, I'm going to be on News Nation Primetime. I'm going to be talking about the mafia boss from Italy that just got sentenced. The guy was on the run for the last, I don't know, 25 years, 30 years?
30 years.
I saw where they got him. Yeah, I saw that.
30 years. They caught him at a doctor's clinic, medical clinic. This guy's got to be fucking older than Sin. Sid, what is he? Do you know, is he like 70 years old or something?
He's not that? Old anymore. That's the new 50.
Well, Sid, you're what?
Is Larry trying to diss on you about your age?
I think so.
No disrespect.
Hey, but you're one with a young, hot girlfriend. So, hey, you know,
it's my charming personality. And besides that, girls like older guys these days.
The system's a joke. I hate to say it's a joke.
Hey, so over here laughing, telling me he just posted something on Facebook, but under my bite, I got a new bite today. I'm very happy about my new bite. So now he's over here making fun of it on Facebook. Apparently, I'm on the show. Bite is cute.
I saw your bite, Lynn. Lynn's got the little bicycle with like the basket on the front. It reminds me of the bicycle
Poppins
from The Wizard of Oz that, like, Toto was riding in the basket in the front. So, Lynn, are you going to put Macklin on the bike and, like, ride down the street with him?
Yeah, she's supposed to be 14. I don't think she can handle it. I mean, well, she's a little chunt, too, for a French bulldog. Oh, my God. Somebody looking like Evel Knievel doing bicycle stuff.
If you need
I want to come
make,
back at Macklin. She's so spoiled.
Lynn, if you need to make she a is. Few extra dollars, that bicycle that you just bought, that's, I think, what is that, a purple bike? Or I'm colorblind. What
no,
color is
it's
that?
Blue. It's blue. It's aqua.
Well, okay, the aqua bike that you just bought, and it's a woman's bike. It's missing the bar in the middle. It's very nice. Lynn told me she got it at Walmart on sale. But, Lynn, that bicycle is suitable for you to have a paper route, should you so desire.
Yeah, but
you get up early
no
in the morning
paper.
And you pull
there's
the
no
newspapers
more paper.
All
really?
The
that's true. What paper so would then, I throw? They're all
exactly.
On
toilet paper.
The legal news.
Toilet paper.
I can deliver laptops to people.
Lynn could go and all be right. Like an Uber food delivery. So, Lynn, you wrote a book also, if I'm not mistaken, didn't you?
Yes. I'm about to publish it as well. I've just been doing some editing to it. And it's good. You read it to me. I liked it.
What's
your book about?
Your book, Lynn?
My book is about my case, about my time in prison, about fighting the feds, about the things that I've witnessed in prison, that, you know, how people are treated.
Okay.
And how you're treated if you dare to try to hold staff accountable. And
well,
just, you know,
see what
really
you just said,
about my case,
Lynn,
about my advocacy stance.
It's how you're treated, okay? It's not about how I was treated. I had these cocksuckers on the run. They didn't fuck with me at all.
You were there at a different time, Larry. I mean, like, that's what we keep comparing notes, but like, you've been home a long time. The BOP has changed significantly.
True.
I hear you. I hear Walt Pablo. I hear a lot of people talk about the heyday of the BOP. Like Sid was just saying, you know, there used to be fairness. People used to get to wear street clothes, women did in the BOP.
Well, if you listen,
let me embellish on
we're
that.
Not like, no.
Let me embellish on that. When I went to prison at the end of 1990 on my money laundering case, which I did go to trial also, they sent me immediately to Nellis, which was a prison camp on Nellis Air Force Base. And I called the lady up and I said, well, when can I come in? She says, what do you mean, when can you come in? I said, well, I got a date of coming in on such and such a date. But I said, I'd really like to turn myself in now. And she says, well, you can't do that. You can't show up early. And I go, well, why not? And she says, well, because that's the date you got to come in. And the reason I wanted to get there early is because I knew the state was hot on my trail.
You know, they will let you self-surrender early, though. If you show up, they have to take you. Did you know that, Sid?
So I have to hide out for a month.
They have to take you, though.
In my buddy's 5,000 square foot mansion, the Civic Palisades, with Playboy bunnies and coke. So I had to hide out for a month. But I finally showed up at Nellis, and I had these two great big bags with me. And the lady says to me, she says, I also did an eight ball before I walked in. She says to me, what are you so happy about? And I says, well, I got to go shopping to come here.
Oh, no. They don't let you bring anything in now.
But then they did. So they told you, go out and buy three pair of pants and a sweatshirt.
Leisure
buy suits,
your
shoes,
Christian Dior sweatsuit, all that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no. No,
but,
baby.
But
I was wearing men's used clothing of khaki.
Yeah.
At
that time, Nellis was like a pleasure spot. I mean, it was like you walk in, up till 4 o'clock, you had to wear the uniform. After 4 o'clock, you put on your self-clothes.
Great.
We actually went into the chow hall, and the Air Force was running it. So we were ordering off menu and eating Air Force chow. It was terrific.
Oh, no.
And we had tennis courts and swimming pool and baseball diamonds.
Do you have
and a weight
pool?
Room. Yes.
Yeah, Brian.
We had all of that. We had single and two man rooms. We lived in Air Force dorms. It was terrific. Who would want to leave?
Do you know what we eat now in prison? The boxes say not for human consumption on some
exactly,
of them.
Exactly, Lynn. Exactly. Not
and
for
and
human consumption.
And in Bryan, there was a big lawsuit. Those guys got indicted in Texas that were selling hamburger meat. One of their particular clients was the BOP, the government. And one of the particular institutions was Bryan, where I'd been eating food. That hamburger meat was made out of cow tongues, cow hooves, all the stuff that's not supposed to even go in dog food. They were selling it, and we were being fed it at Bryan. And really, to be honest, that's not even the worst of the food. Most of it was spoiled, out of date. Milk, you would have to get bags and bags and just smell of all of them. They were all just sour. It is atrocious what they feed. And I was fortunate that I had Poncho to put money on my books and commissary account, and that I was able to buy, you know, what I needed to eat and help other women, because I'm telling you, I felt bad for women that's the only way they got food, because that food was horrible, and not to mention the size portions they gave. Some of those people couldn't even live off that, because I mean,
Lynn, you heard my story about the chicken ass, right? They were cooking up chicken, and then the CO it was gray, and it looked like, I don't know, it looked like these little beaks. And he realized it, after it smelled so bad, that it was the ass of the chicken.
A little ass, chicken huh? ass never hurt anybody.
I know, right?
Listen, I'm going to tell you. I can give you an example that even in today's BOP setting, men get treated better. And here's how I know this.
Okay. Wait a second. Before you get into all that, Lynn, before you get into all that, I just want to bring you up to date. So while I was in the lap of luxury starting my sentence, of course, some news people decided to do a news spread, and they went to, what was the place up north, Larry? We used to call it the Woodshed, Sheridan, right?
Up in Oregon, Larry? Sure.
Yeah, they went to Sheridan, and Sheridan had the same thing we had. They had swimming pool, and they had tennis courts and basketball courts, and, you know, I mean, a decent place to do your nonviolent federal crime. And they did this big expose. Okay, hey, there was guys that were sharing the women's prison in Dublin. And the biggest problem in Dublin is girls were coming up pregnant, and the wives and girlfriends visiting their boys were going, hey, wait a minute, she's pregnant. How did she get pregnant?
So when I was locked up during COVID at FTC Oklahoma, when it came time to quarantine for me to leave, I was moved to the men's max security SHU, by the way, with men as my cell in the next cells and things. Like, they weren't in the cell with me, but they were in, you know, right next door and all around me. We were the only women up there.
So he said you didn't have much privacy with a bunch of perverts.
Well, they were, but that's not even the moral of the story. The way I know that men are treated better was because I saw it in Oklahoma in other ways as well. But this last way was like the icing on the cake. Like, I was offered brand new clothing in the shoe where we're wearing stuff that looked like it hadn't been washed in the women's unit. And the meals were so much better there. Of course, more food, and just the quality of the food was like, oh, like, my God, where's this food been the last 3 months? So even in the max security SHU, where they send people that cannot be in general population because they act so bad and can't function around other people, they have to be locked up in the SHU, the solitary housing unit, they are treated better there than the women are treated in a regular camp or regular unit.
You're right, and here's why. The FTC, the Federal Transfer Center in Oklahoma, sits on the airport. Matter of fact, it's like when you get off the jetway at an international airport or whatever, they have that there. The only difference is you're going off the plane, you're walking off the plane, you're shackled, you're handcuffed, belly chain and all this. You're doing the federal shuffle. So they're admitting you into prison. Nobody really stays in Oklahoma City long enough because it's a transfer center. They probably have a cadre unit there. Oklahoma City, I know Sid wasn't there. Lynn was there. Lynn is an alumni of Oklahoma City and Con Air. Dawn, did you go on Con Air?
Me too.
Okay.
Oh, God, no. I tried that little hustle, and they told me, no, just go self-report. No, I did not go on.
Okay.
I think I heard Wendy say yes in the background.
You're not there long enough in Oklahoma City for them to hate you. They need to move people through the system. And I think Oklahoma City, because I spent time at MDCLA, almost 2 years. That's where I met Sid at. Oklahoma City, they don't have time to fuck around. They even have a little abbreviated commissary. You can buy, I don't know, some cookies or some bullshit.
No, hygiene only.
Yeah, they do. They did when I was there.
This is why.
Not us. Hygiene only.
And this is why.
That's all we got.
Okay, but this is why Oklahoma City treats people better in the SHU, because they're giving people the same food in the SHU. It's the same food across an institution.
I didn't get that food in the unit, though. That's my point. In the women's unit, they don't eat food like
that's right, Lynn. It's a different budget for Oklahoma City. When you got to Bryant, they gave you Gaines Burgers and Donkey Dicks, essentially. Oklahoma City.
No, but I was in the women's unit for 3 months.
Thanks, Larry.
No. I was in the women's unit for 3 months in Oklahoma, and then I got moved to the SHU, and food was amazingly better.
You know, I had some good food at Oklahoma City. It was actually, you only got to eat once, but people were trading different food items and shit for, they were playing cards. I thought Oklahoma City's food was pretty good. Now, maybe the reason they say they treat the women differently is because they're not afraid of the women. They know in a men's facility, if they get out of line, one of those dudes is going to pull out a toothbrush or something. You can make a knife out of paper mache and you could slit somebody's throat with it. They know that the men are more of a threat and the women are more passive and lay downs. So they get away with more in women's facility and in the women's housing units. That's why they do
that. They brought me a cold hamburger one day that looked like it had been sitting in a tray forever. And I told the guy, I shoved it back out at him. I was like, I knocked on the door, made him come back. I was like, I'm not eating this. This is past the serve time. And he was like, he looked at me at first. I was like, no, this is ice cold. Y'all have had it past the serve time because you were serving the end. And I'm going to write you up for this. And he goes, lady, do you not realize you're in prison? I was like, I realize I'm in prison, but I still have rights. This dude grabbed that tray from me, the styrofoam. He went and warmed it up in the microwave and brought it back. Lynn's
like,
didn't
I like put it underneath your armpit to try to warm it up?
Hey, I was the only one that got out there on the carrot. I started administrative remedy.
No, Lynn, you are a go-getter. You did advocate right for people, and at Lexington, they would have put you on administrative move.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I can only say this. The system was a fair system. We had a constitution that protected our rights against snitches and things like that, where they got the fruit of the poison tree. And things that we went to trial on thinking we should be convicted of these things. And we had a prison system that actually functioned and looked after the rights of the prisoner. What happened is the politicians got in, the corporations got in, they made this a business. And when they decided to make this a business, businesses need to show profits for their shareholders. And basically, they just decided to punish people. It became punishment and incarceration instead of trying to bring people around and put them back in the system and treat them like human beings. And now
you have tens of millions
of people that have shared our like experiences. And if you want to change the fucking system, you got to get rid of the politicians that have career jobs that don't want to leave ever. They don't want
mostly
to leave. As a matter of fact,
they're the problem.
Let me tell you. I said to Laura, my lovely girlfriend, I said, I guarantee you this is the first three things you're going to change. They're going to vote themselves a big-ass raise. They're going to be able to smoke in the Congress, and they're going to take away the stanchions where they check for weapons. And sure enough, the first three things that these people did is they got rid of the metal detector, so I can't walk into a federal courthouse without going through a metal detector, but these motherfuckers can walk into the Congress without a metal detector. They put smoking back in the building. When's the last time you were able to buy tobacco in a federal prison or smoke in a jail? Larry, how long has it been? 30 years?
No,
30
it
years.
Was actually
that's that long.
No,
it was 19. Hold on, it was 2000. It was 2004 when I was at Lompoc. That's when they pulled the tobacco.
That's right.
So what, 19 years ago?
That's correct. Yeah. At least over 20. And then who gets a raise? Right off the bat, a 34% raise. Now you want
it's
a
bad
fair
that they can vote that for themselves anyway. Really,
yeah, they can always vote that. And you think they're going to vote in term limits? Not in my lifetime. So
nope.
if you want our prison system to look more like what used to look like, that is now used in the European democratic countries, and if you want a fair and just system of laws that are equal to everybody, then you have to change what's rotten inside the system. And that's the bottom line, folks. You got to change what's
rotten. It's never going to change, Larry.
It's never going to change voluntarily.
Never.
The praise
Listen,
of what social justice
Larry,
did you hear me?
I said this last week. I'll say it this week. Eiselberger, whatever Goldberg he is, got a 5-month sentence for career criminal enterprise, over 15 years of frauding banks, cheating the taxes, doing all kinds of other criminal activity. We're talking thousands, I mean real thousands of crimes done. And he got 5 months. How much time did you say you got, Lynn? 4 years?
Well, I got 45, but that was
45. And how much time did you get, Dawn? You got 6 years?
6 years, 72 months, yeah.
Hey, are
Wendy,
you pissed off now? Because I'm fucking really
hold
pissed
on.
Off.
We have Wendy. Wendy had joined us a while ago, and we didn't introduce her. Wendy, how much time did you get?
180 months.
Oh, my God, for what? To kill someone?
I was a first-time drug dealer.
You were a last time drug dealer, also.
Hey, Wendy,
nobody died.
What was your drug that you were selling?
Probably meth.
For fentanyl. I was Omaha's first opiate case.
Oh, you were doing opiates.
I got 10 years.
I mean, nobody died, but they were mad.
Hey,
they were really mad.
I got 10 years for tearing the tag off the pillow.
How long is
181
years? Then they gave me another 10 years ran concurrent because I was in a national park. I jaywalked and urinated in front of the ranger. So you tell me if things
right
aren't fucked up. All right, we are out of time. I'm going to give Wendy some advice, okay? Wendy, don't call in the last 2 or 3 minutes of the show. You did the same thing a while back.
She's been on for a while. I tried to introduce her, but I couldn't. I tried to when she came on.
All right. We're going to structure this show.
Again.
We're going to structure this show a little bit better the next show. So when somebody is talking, the other person stops talking. We cannot do the run-on. Because it just doesn't fucking work. I wish I had a kill switch. Bump! Or I could cut people off. Anyway, for the Street Justice Show with Larry Levine on Bold Brave TV, we're also simulcasted God knows how many places. I want to thank everyone who watched, because we're on video as well now. I want to thank everyone that listened and remind you that we'll be back next Friday and every Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific and 7 p.m. Eastern. Right now we're doing one-hour shows. I think come February we'll push it back to two-hour shows. So take care and stay safe, and we'll talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Tune in next week for more straight-up, no-holds-barred talk from the host of Street Justice, Larry Levine.